The following is a presentation of Morning Drive Media and the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first broadcast of the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. I'm Cat Napsok, and here we are to start a grand new adventure discussing and celebrating pro wrestling, not burying it in dirt. And we got a great show to lead off this network. I'm very excited to have it here. It is called California Classic Wrestling. And with me is my co-host, and let's face it, really the host. I'm here to guide you through this world. You are the man with the answers here. Dan Farron, professional wrestling historian, commissioner, booker, promoter, referee, and all-around scoundrel.
And guy who's been around long enough and is old enough to remember this stuff. That's always the key to being a historian. It's just being the guy who hangs around the longest to
absolutely
remember.
I'm so excited. Thank you for being here, Dan, to be a part of this network.
Pleasure.
The Wrestling Viewpoint Network it's a pretty simple concept. We are some wrestling fans, aficionados, people who have worked the business. We aren't some flashy, rumor-mongering network here. We're here to talk and celebrate professional wrestling. It's rich history, even the current day stuff. You bring a great audience with the California Classic Wrestling Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done some shows prior to this, which we'll talk about it. So you're bringing in that audience. But I want everyone to realize this network, if you subscribe, and I want you to subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, and anywhere you can get it, we're celebrating wrestling past, present, and the future. Is that fair, Dan?
That sounds fair to me. That sounds good to me. It's an awful lot to do right away off the show, the bat. But we'll proceed slowly, one show at a time.
As with all digital broadcasts, it's an adventure. We are starting this. We're starting this with passion, and we're going to throw this out to the universe. We know there's several other wrestling podcasts. Everyone has one in their own basement, and it's Super Slam Radio. It's Body Slammers. It's all that stuff, and I love a lot of shows. There's a lot of shows that I listen to, and we're going to have some of those people on versus some of the other shows. But the Wrestling Viewpoint Network will start with the California Classic Wrestling, but there's going to be other shows about pro wrestling's greatest matches, wrestling roundtable shows. We got some people lined up for that. Specific ones, maybe the history of women's wrestling, women's wrestling today. I want to do a series on with all apologies to Colt Cabana, an art of wrestling show, but actually, how do you put on matches? We're going to do all that kind of stuff. And also going to have shorter you're going to be able to download shorter 10-minute opinionless pieces from me and other guest commentators. And again, it's all designed to celebrate and talk about and discuss this great American art form.
How about Morning Zoo Wrestling?
Absolutely.
The Morning Zoo. They can, like all the other radio shows.
The Morning Zoogs.
Yeah.
I like to say the Wrestling Viewpoint Network acquired this show. Thank you for the your sale price was...
next to nothing, and I do mean next to nothing.
Next to nothing, and this is going to be our flagship show, a tentpole show, a tentpole franchise, as I might say in the movie industry.
Well, I think before we get started, Ken, you should tell them what your background in wrestling is.
Well, I came into the wacky world of professional wrestling in terms of working the business. Of course, I started watching it growing up in the dark 80s, right, Dan? That's going to be a problem for some of your listeners, right?
The
80s.
Or for me, especially.
I came post-territory.
Barely.
But started working with Millennium Pro Wrestling in 2001 as a manager. My first match, within the first 3 minutes, I had a kick to my face and blood drawn. And I was in the business for real then. And worked with Millennium Pro Wrestling during that time. Stopped when that Fed stopped in 2002. But picked it up again in 2010 when Millennium Pro Wrestling returned in grand style with Rowdy Roddy Piper, and got to be involved with him in that main event, and managed and helped on the creative side and the operational side, and also also for a time period in 2010, wrote for WrestleZone.com, which, yeah, it's one of those online dirt sheets, we can say that. But I am proud to say the editor that hired me, Chris Cash, a great guy, there was a transition, he's still involved, but other people came into power, and I was kind of pushed out because I didn't go the rumor news route. I wrote pieces that celebrated and talked about wrestling, and I was kind of pushed out. So I knew my time in the dirt sheets was over. And that brings us to now. My experience is a smidgen, a little blip on the radar screen compared to yours, sir.
Well, I think, again, it's because I'm older than you. That's the whole reason. That's again, the guy that sticks around long enough gets to be, yeah, I mean, I started out as a fan in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough because I considered myself to be able to be there for like the last 10 years of the territory system, mm-hmm. and then also to be there at the dawn of the cable system and all the different changes that were going on. So it was kind of nice to be there to get a little bit of different styles, much in the same way I think people today look nostalgically back towards some of the 80s stuff and toward the Attitude Era and look at it and say, oh, I remember the good old days back when I was, that kind of stuff.
Side note, I always have that argument, wrestling today sucks. I love the 80s. Really? A man dressed as a tugboat was the glory days of wrestling.
He's actually a member of the page. Don't insult him.
Fred is...
Fred's a very nice man.
I'm just saying. You could say clowns. You could say policemen. Mm-hmm. The gimmicks now, I think, are much more realistic to me. But that's me. So continue, Dan. I interrupted you.
Oh, yeah. No, I just became a fan first, and then I actually wrote for some magazines, and some of them dirt sheets, as you called them. I like to refer to them as newsletters. That's just me.
Back then, that was more accurate.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But did a lot of stuff there. And then I got an opportunity toward the late 1980s to referee, and I broke in Southern California as a referee. And did a lot of shows all throughout the 80s and into the 90s. Mm-hmm. And then as the newer, younger referees came up, because I came along at a time when the referees were in transition. Most of the guys were really much older guys or really young guys. Mm-hmm. And I kind of filled in between there because I was neither one. So I did that. And then I got a chance to start working behind the scenes with different groups, doing some booking. Working with guys, and then I became the commissioner for probably every single federation in Southern California at one time or another.
Your commissioner's clipboard has traveled well,
exactly.
Sir.
And it was a lot of fun, and I still remember my very first wrestling show was in January of 1990. Mm-hmm. For me, it was, and here's the thing is, the phrase mark is thrown around quite a bit, and I don't consider it to be a bad thing. We all mark out for different things.
Yeah.
And it was a great feeling for me to all of a sudden go from watching wrestling to be standing backstage with Chavo Guerrero Sr. and Conan and Rey Mysterio Jr. Mm-hmm. and working on shows.
Right.
And I've always enjoyed that, and I've done that a lot throughout my career. And I joined Millennium Pro Wrestling in 2000, I guess. I guess when it first started. I don't know if it was 2001.
I said 2001. I think it might have been 2000.
Might have been 2000. Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
But have done a little bit of everything. And I also do a lot, as I've talked about in other podcasts with you. I'm fascinated by the history of stuff. It's something that I like.
Sure.
So I want to dig into it. And for me, California wrestling was really something special because it's kind of like remembering your first girlfriend to some extent. And that is, what you grew up with, what you remember as a teenager or as a kid is stuff that's pretty infallible. And that is that when you look back at it, you ignore the warts and and all the mistakes and the things that an adult would see, and you see something that you remember. And as you get older, you watch wrestling, and as you kind of become a little jaded at times, and you've been around it long enough, and you start to say, I saw that in 1987, I saw that in 1986, you know, and you see that kind of stuff come up. But what happens is that you really learn to appreciate it more. And I got a really nice opportunity through a friend who belonged to Cauliflower Alley.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I was being invited to picnics that the Cauliflower Alley guys were having, private ones that weren't being, you know.
This wasn't a baloney blowout.
This wasn't one of those things. These were just guy in a guy's backyard, and I would sit there and I would listen to these guys tell stories. And one of the things I always suggest when you get around wrestlers who have experience and been around for a long time, and this is whether you're a fan or whether you're a wrestler themselves or wannabe, is just shut up and listen to them. Because you'll learn so much from listening to them.
But you shouldn't rush up to them and ask them about what they think about this spot or gimmick. No.
Yeah. No. It's not. It's not a good idea.
Or make is a this, note you know, there.
Or the famous the famous story I've quoted over and over again. There was a guy that I knew who worked as enhancement talent for the WWF, and he walked up to Chief J. Strombo one time and said, "Do you think doing jobs is bad for my career?" And Chief looked at him and said, "What career?" And that's kind of the way I look at it. But LA wrestling, for me, I grew up on the East Coast.
Okay.
And WWF wrestling, while it was still a territory, they had the whole Eastern Seaboard there.
Yeah.
So they were doing New York and Philadelphia and Washington and Baltimore, where I was, and all over the place. And while it was a territory, it was a big territory. It didn't feel, had that hometown feel. And I used to read about in magazines Memphis and Florida and Los Angeles all the time and San Francisco. And I always thought, well, gee, it'd be kind of cool to experience wrestling on TV live or something that was right there. And then sometimes they would do matches that weren't just squash matches, because most of the WWF stuff was squash matches at that time. Very rarely would they do a big match. And if it did, it usually ended up in a double DQ and set up a feud or something. They would do that. So I got very excited about LA wrestling, and I would get the magazines, which the magazines were the only way of really finding out what was going on in the business then.
Yeah.
Or at least the way they presented to you.
It's hard to imagine wrestling before the internet. But
yeah, exactly. And it did. And this stuff was 3 to 4 months behind.
Yeah.
But still, it's the only way you're going to get news. And then I remember the excitement when you'd be watching your wrestling, and all of a sudden you'd see this guy that you've only read about in magazines come in, and there he is live and in person right there. And I wound up writing to a gentleman who I later would become really good friends with, and eventually I considered to be kind of a mentor, Jeff Walton. And I tease Jeff about this all the time. I would send him a quarter taped to a legal pad and say, "Please send me the latest program for the Olympic." And he would send me this program.
That's awesome.
And I still have a lot of those programs.
Great.
And that's and I got hooked on that stuff. And then when we moved out here in 1974, the promotion was already starting to kind of decline a little bit. It went on for another 7 or 8 years. But still, there was something really magical about it. And it really hooked my and kept my interest until girls came along of professional wrestling.
Yeah.
And I've always found that that I can remember certain things from that era that a lot better than I can remember what happened on Raw on Monday night. You know.
Oh, I could name you the 1987 starting lineup for the Yankees. I couldn't tell you who won yesterday. That's the way life works. Now that brings us to the California Classic Wrestling Facebook page, is something you started.
Yeah.
Which turned briefly into a podcast. And tell us a little bit about that Facebook page, when you started it, how, why.
Well, the whole idea was, I originally started the Facebook page because I wanted to do a podcast. And the easiest way for me, because I'm still learning technically a lot of this stuff, and it is, as you well know, putting together this network, not cheap.
No,
to do.
No.
I was looking at doing a regular internet page, and then I decided, well, you know, maybe I should see what kind of audience is out there.
Sure.
So when I and Facebook is free, at least it is now.
Well, yeah, exactly. Depending on the rumors posted and status updates.
Exactly. Yeah. So what I did was almost a year ago, I think it was either late October, early November, I just put up California Classic. And the idea was to follow Southern California. And I thought, maybe I'll get like 50 or 60 people. We can just exchange results and pictures and whatever. Well, it kind of blew up. It kind of surprised me, to the extent where it blew up so fast that I really wasn't ready, and it was doing a lot of work on it. And in the first year, and since we are coming up on our anniversary, as of the time we're recording this, we have 402 members of the California Classic. And we have people who are longtime fans. We have people who want to know more about California. There's a tendency in wrestling a lot to forget about your past. They don't want you to remember that much stuff.
Yeah.
And my feeling always was, every time I would find out that somebody who worked out here passed away or whatever, I would go, that's another link to history, to the past that's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that the men and women who worked in California, who either they spent a short time here or they called it home and spent most of their career here, deserved much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also felt that California also got sort of a short shrift in many cases among a lot of wrestling fans and historians. And part of that was because there's a lot of people that remember different areas, and there's a lot of people that do these festivals and everything. California, not a lot of people talk about California wrestling. And when I would watch these shoot interviews, I would get a shoot interview and I'd be very excited. I remember there was one with Sir Oliver Humperdinck, and I was very excited to get that because he was out here for like a year with the Hollywood Blondes, Jerry Brown and Buddy Roberts, who eventually became one of the Freebirds. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great. It'd be great to hear stories about California.
Yeah.
And the guy that was doing the interviewing was probably about 12 years old, I felt. And that is that when it got to California, this was like a two-hour shoot interview. When it got to California, it was all of maybe a minute and a half. And I think, seriously, the guy said, wasn't Mr. Fuji out there when you were there? And it was like, there was so much stuff.
Well, growing up, too, and this is why California Classic Wrestling Podcast is going to be on the Wrestling Viewpoint Network, or is on the Wrestling Viewpoint Network, is it's a great chance to bridge that gap. I know a lot about wrestling history. I grew up in California, but when I think of the wrestling history, what do I think about? I think about Madison Square Garden. I think about Jerry Lawler in Memphis. Mm-hmm. I think about Florida. I think about Texas.
Yeah.
California, you say it to me, I'm thinking, oh, Piper and the Guerreros.
Yeah.
I think Blassie was out here. Tolos.
Yeah.
Okay. What else you got?
Yeah, exactly.
And so we're not going to, and this is talking directly to your fans from that Facebook page, is we're not going to separate this. We're not going to say, oh, the history of wrestling goes on this separate little thing over here, and you old guys, you remember your past. I want the newer people out there. I want the people who tune into Raw every Monday, and maybe even SmackDown on Friday, the two of you that do. to learn to enjoy this wide berth of history that California wrestling has.
The nice thing about it when you start digging into this stuff is that you see there's a lot of stuff that, I mean, I every day find stuff that I don't know, that I didn't know so-and-so worked out here. I didn't know this person was there. And what's nice about the network of fans and on the Facebook is that not only do we have a lot of longtime fans who, you know, there were guys that were there. I mean, there were guys that would write to me and said, oh, I was there at that show. And that's 1966, you know.
Yeah.
And also at the same time, I've been lucky enough to meet a lot of wrestlers who worked out here, scattered all across the country, who've joined the page, and they put their two cents in. I mean, it's really nice whenever you're talking about something that Chavo Guerrero Sr. jumps on and says, oh, I remember this or that or
I
whatever.
I remember doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And you find out about things, and you're able to straighten them out that way. And that's the reaction I've got from a lot of people who said to me they really appreciate the page because California usually, like I said, doesn't get the credit that it deserves because there's just not enough people remembering it.
Well, we are here to start putting that credit down for all of history, and that's why we're calling this we're 20 minutes in, but we're naming the first episode now California 101. This is me who's I'm learning along with you folks. There's a large selection of the people listening who are learning like me, and that's why it's you and I together. You're learning me, and then we're learning them, and then we're gonna have listeners writing in. They got questions right now. We're not broadcasting live. One day that might change, but if you've got questions or comments, you go to the Facebook page,
right?
And also, we have a Gmail address, wrestlingviewpoint@gmail.com. And if you have a question or a comment or a memory, that's where you find us. And Wrestling Viewpoint is also on Twitter, the entire network, Wrestling VN, Twitter, @WrestlingVN. So, Dan, let's dive in. Okay. You ready?
Yeah, I am ready.
Are you ready?
Yeah, it's one thing that's interesting is when I started doing this, like I said, we did a couple podcasts. We did one with Johnny Legend, one with Jeff Walton, and a couple with Kurt Brown, who's going to be joining us for some future ones. And the funny thing about it is that we did them on those networks that, are like you call in on the phone.
Yeah,
and it just sounds like you're talking to grandma or whatever, and it's and then everybody talks on top of each other. And I really wanted, and the reason I stopped doing the podcast after the beginning of this year, was because I wanted to come to a studio, and I wanted to, and you know, again, we're gonna, we'll eventually have the ability to have people call in and do all this other stuff, but I wanted something that sounded a little more professional, and something that I could actually get out there more than just through these different networks. And what's nice about this is this will be available on iTunes for subscription. It'll be available on Stitcher Radio, so you have all these different options to do it. And
I'm glad you've come to the beautiful Studio City Studios.
Yes.
Here.
I am delighted
the wrestling
to be here.
Viewpoint Network.
And also, what was interesting was when we first started doing this, I got some requests from people in Northern California saying, hey, you know, it'd be nice to
Don't forget about us.
Don't forget about us. And at first, I was like, well, I'll give them a day or two here and there, whatever. But then I started to look at it and think about it. And really and truly, if we can get past the Dodger Giant thing, which is always a problem with a lot of people. But the fact is that the Northern California had a lot of the same guys. There was a little bit of flow over. They're two very different promotions. And I felt that it would be good to honor them, too. So,
absolutely.
Granted, sometimes there's a little more focus on Southern California because that's what I know. But I'm learning a lot about Northern California through a lot of great people on the page.
Well, that's a call to you, the fans of Northern California Wrestling and who's involved with it, Roland.
Roland's very, very vocal on the page.
This is your chance to write in and help us document the history of Northern California Wrestling. Too.
Yeah.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's what we're doing here.
Because it is California altogether, all the way around.
We're going to hold hands across the state.
But when you talk about Wrestling 101, and it's like I said, we're just going to basically kind of touch on some things here on this show, because there'll be a lot of episodes coming up, and we'll delve into things a lot more deeper with guests and whatever, and go over things like that. But I just wanted to kind of give people an overview who maybe don't know that much about California history or just want to listen to some memories about what's going on here. And we were talking, and it's always interesting when people say, one of the Facebook page, I have a time frame on it. It is a niche audience. I do admit that.
Yeah.
It's like around 1900 to the end of the territories, which for Los Angeles is 1982.
Now, what brings you to that determination in 1982?
That's when the Los Angeles promotion closed down.
Gotcha.
So, for all intents and purposes, in Los Angeles, the territory ended in 1982.
Blaming Vince Jr.
No, not blaming any. No, actually, what happened was very interesting is that they went out of business on their own.
Yeah.
And Vince bought into, and that's when the WWF, right before, about a year or two before they started their national expansion, they started doing shows out here at the sports arena. They were on Channel 9 in the mornings out
here.
And that's when they first came back here. But I use that time frame and because these were the golden years of California. And when the territory system died, wrestling changed because it always is evolving. It's always going through a different change of pace or whatever. When I look at Los Angeles, when you put together a list, like when people do their list of the 50 greatest wrestlers of all time or whatever,
Coco, beware.
I always kind of hesitate a little bit because of the different time periods. Because I don't see how you can, I think you should break them up by decades. Like, what are the top 10 of the 20s or the 50s or the 80s or the 90s? Because sometimes it's an entirely different thing. And how do you
measuring,
judge that?
The measuring stick is different. The
measuring stick is different. I always consider for Southern California there were four time periods.
Gotcha.
And that's around 1900. And that's the golden era from 1900 to up around the mid-40s.
Okay.
That was the time frame when wrestling itself was changing because, we've all heard the stories about, Catch as Catch Can and Greco-Roman. They were and the Civil War soldiers, did that. Yep. And they had these matches out in fields or whatever. But wrestling was starting to change around then.
Yeah.
They first started working matches, and that is
the dreaded word working.
The dreaded working around 1915, 1920. Gotcha. And by the way, if anybody says, Dan, you're off, just send me a note. I'm fine with that. I have no ego when it comes to history. Right. I want the history to be right. So if I'm not correct, let me know. But what happened was a lot of things started to change, and the matches moved from outside into arenas and saloons and opera houses. And the promoters started to kind of take control, much in the same way that the promoters do now.
Right.
What they did was they stepped in and they said, okay, you know, William Muldoon has matches that, not joking, last 7 to 9 hours.
I mean,
there was one promoter who actually turned the lights off in the arena one time because the match just was going on and on and on. And so what they did was a lot of the promoters started to realize also if they had a world champion, they basically controlled wrestling in that area.
Gotcha.
So these guys all started – that's why there were so many world champions around the turn of the century. And what happened was all the promoters started putting together alliances and trust and all these different things. And we're going to get into that one day because it is fascinating. It's like the Godfather is what it is. It's like all these guys, they had this guy, and then that guy double-crosses them, and then they double-cross this guy. And, well, you know.
You hear of the Gold Dust Trio. I always reference
exactly.
that. Kind of, you hear about the turn-of-the-century promoters. It is fascinating.
Yeah.
It definitely
warrants
its own show.
And what happened was, and it warrants actually a couple shows because it's that big of a story. But what also happened was the promoters started looking at this stuff and saying, you know, we need time limits on these matches or we're going to be here all night.
We're losing cities, not just crowds.
And because of the fact that wrestling had no season, it was kind of hard for wrestling fans to get behind a home team because there wasn't a home team.
Gotcha.
So what happened was wrestling started recruiting a lot from football, from local college football. Because if you had a football player who was part of your hometown team, then you would come to see them. And out of that is kind of where the babyface heel thing developed. Because if you had a really big hometown hero, you know, that one of those guys, and that's, you know, then you were going to basically maybe pay money to come and see them, you know, work. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing if you look at, and again, I'm not saying any of the mixed martial arts things are fixed. I'm not. What I'm saying is
only
that
the NBA is. Only Let's NBA get is. It right.
What I'm saying is that you notice now when they're in their transitional periods, they're trying to build up characters, and there are natural characters who are kind of face characters, and there are natural fighters who are kind of heel characters. And that's something you look at, they joke about it, but even in football and basketball and baseball and stuff. There is a tendency to build those characters up. I know, even in roller derby, when roller derby was always interesting because your home team would skate clean, but when they went someplace else, they'd skate dirty. Right. And you talk about your Yankees. I always talk about there was a while in the 70s that Thurman Munson looked awful much like a heel to me.
You remember when the Yankees turned face in 96?
Yes, exactly.
And they went heel in 2000.
Exactly. And the thing was, they also started encouraging more flashy moves, and wrestling started to move and change like it always does. They also noticed that silent movies and stage plays and things like that encouraged a villain and a hero and people that could boo and hiss them. And they also found that immigrants that came over to this country found it very easy to figure out what was going on.
Right.
And also found that it was that if you developed a hometown hero who was of a certain ethnic persuasion, what happened was those people would live or die to see. I mean, they always joked about it. For Bruno Sammartino in New York, the Italians showed up, and for Pedro Morales, the Puerto Ricans did.
Right.
And then for a while in Mid South, when Junkyard Dog was there, they were attracting within the groups all together there, and that's kind of where wrestling went to. So what happened was you started having all these double crosses and everything. Mm-hmm. And also, actually, when they started doing the when they got into the Depression in World War II, and after that, they started developing gimmick matches and stipulation matches. The tag team match supposedly originated in San Francisco in 1901. It wasn't really popular until the 1930s in Texas, and that's when actually they had all four guys in the ring at the same time. But those were things that they would do. Also, you saw a lot of as America went through wars, you saw a lot of foreign heels, things developed that way. And a lot of the biggest names in professional wrestling came through Los Angeles during those golden years. And you can find results going back 80 to 90 years of Ed Strangler Lewis, right, of John Pesek, the Nebraska Tiger Man, all these fascinating guys who either got started at AT, at what was called athletic shows or carnivals, and developed and worked their way through. You know, that's another thing. When you look at, they always joke about the carnival background of wrestling. Well, the carnival wrestling was never, rarely, ever on the up and up. They always, you know, they would always have a person in the, a plant in the crowd or whatever.
A mark
or whatever. And I remember one guy telling me a story one time about how they had the ring set up where there was actually a backdrop next to the ring. And if the local guy was in there and the guy that they had working for them couldn't control the local guy, he would work the local guy back toward the backdrop and someone would take like a blackjack and whack him through the backdrop to give the guy an advantage. So you had all these things going on, and you had all these great wrestlers come through, including Jim Londos, who a lot of people refer to as one of the first and one of the best, if not greatest, babyface of all time. He was, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, what made him so?
Well, a lot of different things. First of all, he was a good-looking guy, so that appealed to women, and he was a man's man,
yeah,
and he was a common man. He was... he also was Greek, so he appealed to a lot of Greek immigrants at that time. And he was a guy that the promoters latched onto quickly. And like I said, there's a great book by Greg Oliver and another gentleman whose name escapes me right now about heroes and babyfaces. And they picked Londos as the number one babyface of all time.
And what was his prime era? What are we looking at?
We're looking at 20s and 30s. I mean, he drew some unbelievable crowds. I mean, he in 1931 he drew $70,000 at Yankee Stadium.
70,000 people or dollars?
No, dollars. He made drew 70,000. Okay. Yeah, I mean, the gate was $70,000 at Yankee Stadium. In 1934 the gate was $60,000 at Fenway, and he did an $86,000 gate at Wrigley the same year.
Wow.
So people were connecting with him, and people liked him. And he was one of those guys that he was a natural, nice guy, and he would go to hospitals, and he would kiss babies and do all those things.
Make a wish before it was.
Yeah, exactly. And so you had all these different guys there. And one of the keys to Southern California wrestling at that point was the development of the Olympic Auditorium.
Okay.
The Olympic Auditorium was dedicated and completed in 1925, and in 1926... is when they first opened it up for boxing. And it was also, basically also built for the Olympics.
Thus the name?
Thus the name.
I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Sounds stupid, but I've always wondered
that.
Well,
no, that is the exact name. And it was down at 18th and Grand. And the idea of it was with the founding fathers in the city was they were hoping that they could... that this auditorium would be able to draw people in for conventions and for sporting events and would help raise the area and help improve the area.
And you have this newspaper clipping that I'm staring at right now.
I have a newspaper clipping from the 19, and we'll have to put this up, from the 1926, 24, no, actually 25 or 24, Herald Examiner, which is a drawing of the Olympic Auditorium, and it says auditorium will seat 15,000 people.
Wow.
And I found that deep in the bowels of the public library downtown in Los Angeles in the old Herald Examiner.
You went on some microfiche for
that. Yeah, I did some big time one there. But the building was an amazing building. I don't know. Have you ever been in the Olympic Auditorium?
I have not.
I actually was lucky enough to referee there one time, and I got to tell you, everybody who goes in there. Everybody from Freddie Blassie to Roddy Piper has said that there's something about that building.
Mm-hmm.
When you walk in, there's all the pictures of the wrestlers and the boxers that work there, all that stuff there, and everybody just feels the ghost of the Olympic Auditorium.
Is it cathedral-like?
It is cathedral-like, and the way it's shaped, if you go up in the bleachers, that's a real steep drop. But
right.
No matter where you were, you could see. And it just had that special feel. And the ring they had there, the ring was a gigantic ring. I think it was 28 by 28 or something like that.
Wow.
And it was, and the joke was that you could whip the guy in the ropes and go get a soda and come back by the time he made it back.
Just to put that in reference for people now, a WWE ring is usually 20 by 20,
yeah,
if I'm correct.
Like
and
that.
You can sometimes go down as far as 16 by 16 for some indie feds.
And was as hard as concrete.
Yeah.
Was. It's just Roddy Piper always, the first thing whenever you talk to Roddy Piper about LA, he says that ring.
Yeah.
That ring. The apron was kind of interesting, too, because you had a big old wide apron there because it was so big. Mm. It was about 3 feet that you could stand on the apron there.
I'm trying to wrap around my brain around 28 feet by 28
yeah,
feet.
Exactly. And actually, I have a quote here from Freddie Blassie wrote in his book about the Olympic Auditorium. He says, when you walk through the door and you saw the pictures of all the greats in the lobby, you couldn't help but feel like you were part of that tradition.
Right.
And that's true. When you stand there, you feel the ghost of people.
That's what I mean. A cathedral
through.
To the past.
It is.
The Yankee
Which is
Stadium type
ironic
thing.
Ironic because,
yeah.
Luckily there were many attempts over the years to tear it down and to build parking lots there, which would have just been a shame. They tried to revive it 2 or 3 times. But they wound up eventually doing was they sold it to a Korean church. So it is now actually a cathedral to some extent.
It's quite
it's a
literally.
Church. It is, and it's still down there. It was, some guys referred to it as the bucket of blood because it was a rowdy place in its time.
Sure.
Riots broke out there all the time. And when I'm talking riots, I'm talking your Major League Class A riots.
Right.
I'm talking... people urinating in cups and throwing that. I'm talking about people throwing rolls of quarters from the upper deck.
Right.
There is a rumor that somebody did one time pull seats up and set fire to it and throw it off the upper deck too. So the thing was that when you were at the Olympic, it's not unusual if you look at old newsletters or papers from that time that somebody will write and say, this happened, then John Tolles beat Ernie Ladd and a riot broke out. Then so-and-so beat so-and-so and a riot broke out. And they were rough. I mean, the crowd at the Olympic was so rough, and this was not just for wrestling, for boxing there too. There are many, many stories of boxers being carried out on stretchers and fans throwing stuff at them because they're mad.
Right.
They lost or whatever to do that. But I have I'd like to have you read this. There's Ryan Doyle, who is a very good friend of mine who's also a member of the page, wanted to share a memory he had of about the Olympic Auditorium.
Right, and he has a question for us. So you're going to answer this question, right?
Well, no. This was his opinion. That's it.
Oh, I was hoping through this you'd have some Swami-like answer for solve Ryan's problem. Ryan Doyle writes, who also is a spectacular guy, despite him rooting for the Angels and not the Yankees, says that Southern California wrestling is special to me because it was in the background of my raising and a passion shared with my three brothers and my grandmother. And he says he has two favorite memories. Escaping with my life intact. My life intact as someone started shooting his gun towards the ring where my brothers and I were sitting. Just run that through your head, folks, the next time you think you see an offensive sign in a WWE crowd. Someone was shooting a gun, and then Ryan continues to say, and watching my brother Larry do what my brothers and I still refer to as the frosty snowman slide down the slanted metal ramp and getting up and strutting off as though no one saw what had just happened. Explain that. Explain the ramp.
The ramp. They had different ramps there. But there was a great rumor that there was, and I have asked Jeff Walton about this, and sometimes it's true, but there supposedly there was a escape hatch under the ring that if things got too bad, you would go under the ring and out again.
Did they just build that for Piper?
Yeah, it was there because, I mean, the long before Roddy was there, there were riots there. As you were saying, the Olympic became the cathedral. And it eventually, and that's why over the years, whenever an independent group, like either it be XPW or ECW or UWF, and that was the old Mid-South group at one point, they all wanted to go to the Olympic because it felt like they were touching legitimacy.
Yeah.
And there was something about doing it there that made it, you know, special, because again, as you were saying, Madison Square Garden in New York, and then you know, and in the Sportatorium in Texas, and out here, Cal Palace in Northern California, and out here, the Olympic.
Well, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a late 50s LAPD officer, and I was telling him what I was doing with the show, and he doesn't watch wrestling now. He doesn't, and he goes, "Oh, that sounds great." He goes, first words out of his mouth, "The Olympic." He used to go there all the time, and described seeing Tolos and Bobo Brazil wrestling and all that kind of stuff. So it is definitely carries that impact. It does. Is the place
and
out here.
It was, and then what happened was, you know, you had the promoters all, you know, moving around, and there was a guy named Carnation Lou Darrow. Mm-hmm. Yes, Carnation Lou Darrow, who was from Austria, who was a former strongman with the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. He was in control of the Olympic for a while, and then things happened there, which we'll talk about some other time. And
we're going to dedicate an entire show to the Olympic. We're going to get Scott Walton and his dad Jeff to get in.
Yeah, we want to get them to come down here and do
Studio
it again.
City Studios,
but when the Olympic. When the Olympic closed down, it was like shutting down part of the history of Los Angeles. And it's a shame that we do that a lot out here in LA. There's a lot of, you know, wrestling has always been, it can draw, but it's always been difficult here because there's so much other stuff to do.
Right, absolutely.
You know, there's all these other things. But at one point, you know, anybody who was going to the Olympic, and there was also Hollywood Legion Stadium, which was, I think, is now a Bally's on Hollywood Boulevard, which was another place built for boxing and for wrestling. And that was very popular when TV came in, and that was the next big time frame was television. And because there's so much television out here, a Southern California wrestling fan had wrestling on from some place in the country every night of the week and twice on Saturday and Sundays. And a lot of the promoters started using television to kind of manipulate against live shows. They would schedule like their television show to air the same night as a live show aired to try to, you know, to take control. So you got into that. But then what happened was a lot of promoters, if they had somebody like a Nature Boy Buddy Rogers or somebody who wanted them to come to California because they could get that national publicity and they could get some seasoning by appearing on TV and getting used to it. And then also by the time they came back to their own territory, now they're a big deal. Now they've been seen on TV. And of course, the man who, if television hadn't invented him, he would have invented television, and that was Gorgeous George.
Absolutely.
A guy who basically took a gimmick and ran with it. And it was one that was perfect out here and worked here when he went back east and was doing some other stuff. It didn't quite follow with him, but and it's a sad story that everybody's has heard. But still, he was the perfect mercenary for a short little war. And he was the guy who sold TV sets. And if you didn't even watch wrestling, you knew who Gorgeous George was.
Absolutely.
And that was one of the keys there.
Transcended the ring.
He did. And then what happened was TV started to you know, kind of become a normal thing. Everybody had TV. And what happened was in the 1960s, was probably the decade of the 60s was probably for Los Angeles wrestling the strongest from a bench position. I mean, the guys they had out here, you had Fred Blassie, you had John Tolis, you had Mil Máscaras, you had Bobo Brazil, you had all these guys. Plus, also, with the development of wrestling in Japan and in Mexico, you had guys coming up from over the border to work here, which they maybe would work here and never work anyplace else, you know. And you had guys on their way to Japan and Australia who would stop off and wrestle here for one or two nights or whatever before they go on. So you had a nice pick, you know, as you went through. And also with the Japanese wanted to be on American TV. So you found that Giant Baba and Antonio Inoki both kind of cut their teeth originally working in Southern California and in Northern California. And but that whole time frame of the 1960s, when I look at the results and look at who wrestled out here. You had Nick Bockwinkel, who was wrestling with his father, Warren Bockwinkel, at that time. You had virtually anyone who was. And somebody wrote to me recently and said, "Wow, that result." Because what I do every day on the page is I put up a result for that day in history from different time frames. And somebody wrote and said, "Wow, that must have been a really loaded car." And I said, "No, that's actually the guys who were here at that time."
There was no mid card, huh?
No, there was. I mean, there were mid card guys, but still, I mean, you had some of the biggest names of wrestling at that point. Mm-hmm. And then also, you were lucky enough to have guys like Jimmy Lennon, who was the ring announcer, and Dick Lane, who was the play by play guy. And these are both guys that when the Wrestling Observer set up their Wrestling Hall of Fame, they went in first. Mm-hmm. I mean, they went in before a lot of wrestlers did, because a lot of people have said that outside of maybe Howard Finkel, you know, Jimmy Lennon and Howard Finkel are probably the two of the best, if not the best, ring announcers of all time. And I had the pleasure of being able to hear Dick Lane call matches. And he was absolutely amazing. And he's another guy that you would want to do an entire show on, you know. Mm-hmm. Plus, also, you had the phenomenon in Japan of Riki Dozen, who was the Korean-born star who passed himself off as Japanese, and came out here and traded the world championship with Blassie and some other guys once or twice. And that kind of legitimized him, and also legitimized a lot of the guys working in Southern California at the same time. In Northern California, it was a kind of a different situation, because there are two offices, and they're both as different as night and day. In Northern California, the main person that is usually, and there was other people there at one point, but you had a guy named Roy Shire, who was a wrestler and decided he wanted to start his own promotion, and he wanted to do it in San Francisco. And he tried to buy the promotion that was there, and the guy didn't want to sell. And
this is an NWA stronghold area, right?
Well, this is, yeah. Now, that's the other thing, was the NWA came along at that point, and they basically, a lot like the mafia, you know, set it up. I mean, they basically, if you worked for the NWA and somebody tried to come into your territory, then all the NWA partners would send in their biggest names to drive those people out. And there have been situations. In 1969, Vern Gagne tried to do an AWA invasion at the Forum with Jack Kent Cook. That didn't go very well.
Which fascinates me that it wasn't just Vince Jr. expanding. No, other people have tried before.
They all wanted to. Mm-hmm. Roy Shire himself in the early 60s with Bill Welsh, who was the commentator in wrestling here in the 50s, tried to go into the sports arena. And those things, those are stories, they never, ever worked. Because that's the thing, is these guys spent most of their lives trying to double-cross each other. That's what they did. Mm-hmm. But the one of the few times that it did work was with Roy Shire, who basically had figured out the product, was a booking genius, and he did an invasion in the NWA stronghold in San Francisco, and he basically won out, which you can imagine didn't put him in great favor with the NWA,
right?
Which was interesting, because and truly down here at that point, what happened was the LaBelle brothers, Mike LaBelle and Judo Gene LaBelle, two people who are as opposite as day and night, were basically by that time had taken over from their stepfather Cal Eaton, their adopted father, and was running the wrestling ends. Mike LaBelle had no real wrestling background. He was basically a businessman. Roy Shire had a lot of wrestling background. Mike usually let the guys, he was smart enough to put guys in charge of his booking and his shows that were really bright when it came to wrestling. He had a guy named Charlie Moto, Mr. Moto, who worked behind the scenes along with a guy named Jules Strongbow. Jay Strongbow probably got the Strongbow name from Jules. But they worked for a long time at it. And then eventually Freddie Blassie and John Tolis at different times took over the book. Freddie Blassie supposedly was very was very anal retentive, and that is that he would come in with his little notebook about what they've done, what they planned on doing, what each wrestler could do. He would show up a half hour early, and he was ready for those booking meetings.
Right.
And also Jeff Walton, who was a fan and president of the International Freddie Blassie Fan Club and became the publicity director there and also had a great mind for wrestling.
Yeah.
So they were lucky enough to have those kind of people there. Meanwhile, up in Northern California, Roy Shire has a guy named Ray Stevens, who's one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, a guy that a lot of people crib from today. That people, when people see the, when Flair used to do the flip in the corner, that was Ray Stevens. When Bobby Heenan did the flip in the corner, that was Ray Stevens.
Gotcha.
And you had Pat Patterson, who is well known to WWE fans now, as being a guy also who Stevens and Patterson tagged together, then they feuded together. So you had, and then you had other guys like Pepper Gomez and the Northern California wrestling had a tendency to be a little more serious. Southern California got a little wacky at times.
So let's get into that difference. What's explain that?
Well, I say a little wacky. They had there was a mummy that wrestled here. And to let you know, I mean, just to show you how times change, the gentleman Benji Ramirez, who was the mummy, it got everybody. I mean, this is a guy in a mummy outfit. You would think that people would laugh.
Yeah.
Okay. But he got stabbed by a guy, an old man with a penknife, on the way back to the dressing room after a match of Pedro Morales in Pasadena. And if you read the newspaper clippings, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, he could have died, but the newspaper clippings played the whole thing up like it was the funniest thing in the entire world. You know, and it was the strangest thing there.
Wrestling.
Later on, in some of toward the end of the promotion in the 70s, we had the famous monster, and we've talked about that's a favorite. That's something that it's kind of looked upon with very much tongue in cheek and kind of like, oh, it was an interesting idea. There was a wrestler in Arizona who wrestled under a Frankenstein mask,
right?
And there was never any push or whatever that claiming that he was the Frankenstein monster. When he came to California, they said basically that a gentleman named Pete Collins, who was a manager of some wrestlers, and it wasn't a big name in the Olympic, but he was a guy there. Supposedly that Pete Collins had built him in a laboratory, had created this monster, which was interesting because Pete Collins, as far as I know, had a TV repair shop in San Bernardino. I don't know if he built him in the back room there.
Makes sense.
But they brought him in as this terrifying monster, and I don't want to talk too much about that because the gentleman is still around, and I do want to get a hold of him.
Absolutely.
Who played the monster. But, I mean, they eventually even turned him babyface, and, you know, they had, like, come out early and get your picture taken with the monster, kids, and you could sit on his lap, you know.
When did the wrestling beetle work? Whatever.
That was in the Beatles era. That was, they brought him in I think it's George Ringo. That's what they called him. It didn't last very long because even especially in the 60s, that stuff was frowned upon by the other guys.
Really?
You know, it's like, it doesn't, you know, they don't want to beat a guy who's kind of a joke, you know. But we did have the bionic wrestler. We had the bionic wrestler, who was Lars Anderson or Larry Hymanimi, an adopted member of the Anderson family, and he had supposedly he had something implanted in his arm, and he had a manager who would come to the ringside in a lab coat with like a transistor radio or something like that, and at some point what he would do is if he was losing the match, he would do like, kind of like the axe or the lariat type move on him, and the professor would turn up the juice so that way it would knock the guy out at the end. And I think what happened is a lot of the fans kind of took that kind of tongue-in-cheek and kind of went with that. Whereas I don't think that would have lasted 5 minutes in Northern California. And that goes to show you also, again, Roy Shire and Mike LaBelle hated each other. Oftentimes, you would see the U.S. title, which was the main title in San Francisco, defended on a show in L.A., but very rarely did you ever see the L.A. title defended on a show in San Francisco. And when Shire went out of business about a year or so before, when they couldn't draw the Cow Palace anymore, what happened was he called up John Hall from the Los Angeles Times down here and basically did an expose the business interview with him. which was meant to hurt business here because it was like a one last parting shot. And neither one of these guys, I said, either we got along well with the NWA. For a long time in the 60s, the group, they had dropped out of the NWA, and it was the WWA. And finally, at the end of the 60s, they went back to the NWA. And they stayed, and L.A. stayed with them to the very end. But, you know, if Roy Shire got mad, he'd bring in somebody else's champion. You know, he didn't care. So, I mean, they were two very, very different very different promotions, and like I said, I want to have. We plan on having somebody from who's very familiar with the San Francisco. I've been talking to some guys who are very familiar with the San Francisco area, and that they would come in and fill in the spots that I'm not really aware of. But in L.A., what happened was by the time I got out here, it was after the famous Coliseum car, which we're going to talk about on the next show.
Yeah,
and what happened here was that the promotion was beginning to go into decline. It was just difficult to get a lot of the big name wrestlers out there back into back to come through to California. A couple things saved them and gave them several years more than they would have had probably if it hadn't. And that was the Guerrero family, Chavo Guerrero and Mondo Hector, and their father Gory. They came along at a time and really was able to boost the crowd. Again, they were the perfect baby face. Mm-hmm. They were superheroes who could do all kinds of maneuvers that most people couldn't do, but at the same time, there was identifiability with them. Mm-hmm. They felt like your neighbor. They felt like a friend.
Right.
And that was one of the reasons. Now, of course, if you have a really good baby face, you need a dance partner. You need a heel. And Red Bastine, who helped me out quite a bit when I first got in this business, very, very nice man, was working down in Texas, and he calls up Leo Garibaldi, who was the booker out here, and says, I got this kid. He's on his way to Oregon. But let's run him through. He's still kind of brand new. And he wears a kilt, and he plays bagpipes.
Right.
And he came in as a babyface. Mm-hmm. I saw his debut in Southern California in the San Bernardino Arena. Which, by the way, was my favorite arena of all time. That was one of the greatest places. They turned that now into a Department of Water and Power building.
As it should.
But that was built for boxing and for wrestling, and it was really a great place. And I was there every Sunday night for as long as I possibly could, and saw Harley Race defend the NWA title against Andre the Giant and stuff like that going on. But Roddy Piper came through, and he was only supposed to stay for a little while and then move on. And the third thing that happened that was really good was they hired a guy named Leo Garibaldi to be the booker. Leo Garibaldi is a genius when it comes to booking. And you ask anybody from Jeff Walton to Les Thatcher to anybody who's been around this business will tell you that Leo Garibaldi knew how to book and knew how to get crowds in there. And they brought him in. First of all, he was a referee. So there was not a chance of him putting himself over or getting himself out there or putting the belt on him or doing any of that stuff. Right. And he grew up in a wrestling family. His father was a wrestler. He started tag teaming with his father in the 1950s. Oh. He learned the wrestling business from the ground up. And he was so smart. I mean, if he was in the ring refereeing a match and he realized that the crowd was a certain way or he could do something else, he would change the finish in the match. In the ring. So, I think this is going to work. So one night they're driving down to San Diego, and Garibaldi says, I think I'm going to turn this kid. And they're like, well, why do you want to turn? He wears a kilt. He plays bagpipes. What are you going to do with him? He goes, no, there's something there.
Yeah.
The famous, there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something there. And that character took off. And what they did was it probably gave the territory a good 3-5 years more than it might have had without them. And then eventually, the territory closed down when a lot of the names had moved on. And the fact was that it was hard to get TV. Nobody was giving you TV for free or paying you
anymore,
TV anymore.
Things had changed.
And they lost Channel 13, which was their English station, in 75. And they were doing okay on the Mexican channel, on the Spanish International Network. But what happened there was that eventually those networks started to be eaten up by on TV and the different cable systems mm-hmm. that came along. So at that point, the music died, as Don mm-hmm. McLean might say, and that's what happened there.
So we're now deep into the 70s.
Yeah.
Piper and the Guerreros, the 74, 75 era, if mm-hmm. I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
So did you see it? Did people inside see this end coming? Is it something they you're mentioning the TV and everything?
I've talked to people, and I've actually wanted to talk to more people who were there at the mm-hmm. end and saying, what did it feel like? Was it
right.
like, you know, because the thing is, if you've ever worked in a promotion that's closing, you know what happens is eventually as you start to get that feeling that the end is near.
You're talking about my 2013.
Yes, exactly. But you start to get that feeling, and you know, sometimes it ends quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it drags for a real long time.
Right.
And that's what basically I think that a lot of people realized that the promotion was in trouble, but they kept hoping something would pull it out.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble was, when you lost TV, you were dead.
Right.
And that's what happened to the promotion.
Mm. It's hard to say why someone would lose TV, but was it society changing as it is now? I mean, the view of wrestling started to change from the 50s to the 60s. By the 70s, were people just too cynical?
Well, I think that's making it a little bit deeper than it actually was.
the philosophy of why wrestling.
Because wrestling has always been around. I mean, when mm-hmm. wrestling wound up going off the networks mm-hmm. in the 1950s, and that it retreated to UHF and to rabbit ears,
right.
and you wound up picking up on Channel 43 or 47 mm-hmm. or whatever. And it then with cable, all of a sudden everybody wanted wrestling, and it was all over the cable. And
yeah.
then it started to kind of filter out again. And I think that what happened in the old days was that the guys, everything was free. They set up a barter system type for the television shows. And when it started to become too expensive to do these shows for free, or they wanted to be charged, because I mean, that was the whole thing. Most of these guys always would go in and say, you know, I'll just, you know, we'll give you this. One of the things that scuttled the KCOP TV show
mm-hmm.
was their, basically, when you look at a wrestling show, a TV show, it's an infomercial.
Yeah.
At least in the old days, it was an infomercial show. And you had to be really careful about how much of an infomercial it was.
Right.
And evidently there was a situation, and I've talked to Jeff Walton about it, and we should talk to him again about it, because
sure.
I'd like to clarify it a little bit. A situation with Greg Valentine,
mm-hmm.
where Valentine plugged it a little bit too much, and because mm-hmm. of that, they got the network got panicking with FCC and all that kind of stuff, and just mm-hmm. said, nope, we're done doing it.
Wow.
We're not going to do it anymore.
Hmm. We'll definitely have to clarify that. Maybe we can get the hammer in as well.
Just, sure. Boxcar.
Yeah.
That's
okay. So we're coming down to the end of this introductory show, a history lesson of California wrestling, both north and south.
Yes.
We're now here. We're in the late 70s, early 80s. It's winding down. Where do you want to take it? Where do you want to close with it, Dan?
I think for me, you were asking about when I first took a look at it. By that time, I was in college, and I turned it on one time, and there was a character called Robot C3. And I said, I think we've reached the end. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you grow up and you become an adult, and things change, and you have to accept that. And that's what happened with wrestling, is that at that point, I personally moved on. I mean, mm-hmm. I would still watch wrestling. I still watch wrestling to this day.
Yeah.
I'm not always as enamored by it or excited by it as I was in the old days, but I still watch it. I'm still drawn into the whole pageantry of it. And you know, I mentioned to you before that it was interesting, because when I first saw wrestling as a little kid, it scared me. I was sitting on my father's shoulders.
Yeah.
And he said to me, don't worry, it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike a lot of kids growing up, I never for once ever believed wrestling was real because my dad told me it wasn't real.
Right.
But at the same time, there is something fascinating about it.
Yeah.
And everybody always wants to join the circus, as they say.
Yes.
And even though I resisted it for years or whatever, there was something very magical about making that happen. And I look back at and I've done that on a small scale. And I look back at the Olympic and what those guys were doing then. And when I've talked to the people, like, you know, talked to Jeff Walton about it, I said to him on the last interview I did with him, do you miss it? Do you ever wish you could go back?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, of course I do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the whole thing about it is if you've been involved with it, if you just want... You want something to catch that spark. You want to turn, you know, people get excited sometimes when they watch something and like on Raw and something happens and it says, it made me a fan again, or it made me a little kid again. That's what we're all looking for.
Yeah. And we're gonna do a show. I haven't even told you yet. We're going to do a series of shows where it's going to delve into what makes us like wrestling. And I'm going to bring some just straight up fans, people who aren't on the inside or haven't worked indie feds or anything. Just go to shows because it is fascinating. That's the coaster I warned you about earlier.
Exactly. Falls. Yeah, I didn't.
And I've given up trying to explain why I love wrestling to
you
people.
You can't. I mean, we talked about this before. Remember, we talked about guys who are like – get so upset if their friends don't respect the fact that they're a professional wrestler.
Yeah.
And we've said, why are you worried about those people? Because they're not going to like it. There's nothing that's going to make them like it. You know. And I was reading an article in the paper the other day, there are professional haters. That is, there's people who watch certain shows on TV and they hate them, but they watch them because they want to hate them.
You have to be careful because that's how I became a fan of the Spice Girls. As a rock DJ in the 90s, I would campaign rail against them every day. Mm-hmm. I now own all their movies, albums, and figures.
Of course.
Well, this has been a show dedicated to California Classic Wrestling, California 101, the history of wrestling in Southern California. We have taken you on quite a journey from the turn of the century. And by the way, NorCal, you get credit for creating tag team wrestling in 1901, according to his historian Dan Farron.
Oh, and by the way, also to mention Jim Lanos, you said, why is Jim Lanos important? I mentioned this before. He actually is the inventor of the sleeper hold. There's a piece of trivia for
you. Absolutely.
Just for that alone, he would be important.
And future episodes. Let's take a little bit here to talk about some future episodes of California Classic Wrestling. If you're listening for the first time and you're not familiar with Dan's Facebook page, so glad to have you. Go find him on Facebook. The Facebook page is California Classic Wrestling.
Right. Exactly.
Is there a unique URL for that?
There probably is, but I never can figure it out.
Facebook.
So that's
Facebook's a little confusing in that regard.
Yeah, exactly. So I would just basically go California Classic Wrestling, or you can just check me out, Dan Farron, F-A-R-R-E-N, and I'll be more than happy to guide you to it.
Absolutely.
We have a lot of fun on the page, and it's really something, if you are a fan, you'll love it, and if you want to just learn about what's going on. It's historian-like, but it's not heavy historian, and you won't be made fun of if you don't know anything about it.
No, please, because otherwise you'd be making fun of me all night long. I am learning myself, but some future shows within this podcast, the California Classic Wrestling Podcast. Of course, we're going to do top 25 most influential wrestlers. Are we going to divide it up?
We're going to divide. We're going to do the top 25 of Southern California and the top 25 of Northern California.
Okay.
I'm also working on a couple different guests I can't really mention right now to bring into the studio. And I mentioned it just in passing. We recently passed the anniversary of the biggest card in wrestling in Southern California history, in all California history, actually, and that was the famous show at the Coliseum. And our next show, we're going to basically talk about that in a little bit of detail, how that was set up and how that came about.
Episode 2 is going to be that. But one of my points to saying this, folks, of what's coming up is, so this is where you get involved. You need to go find the Facebook page, the group California Classic Wrestling, and start listing who you want us to talk about. Who are your favorite wrestlers from growing up? Maybe you grew up in the 50s or earlier. Maybe it was the 70s and you want to talk about Piper and the Guerreros until the dawn of end of time. Get involved, and you can also write us again at wrestlingviewpoint wrestlingviewpoint@gmail.com. No AOL addresses accepted. Wrestling Viewpoint. And just write us, share a memory, correct Dan on a fact.
Right.
He's big enough to take it.
I can take it.
And follow us on Twitter at WrestlingVN. That's at WrestlingVN. And share your thoughts as well. This is going to be interactive as best we can from a taped podcast. Until we find a good way to go live, we're not just going to jump on phones, as Dan said, and do a call-in via phones. This is going to grow. This is an adventure. It is a journey. I'm so glad you guys are all on board on the journey.
Yeah, and I appreciate it, too. And like I said, I also appreciate all the help and all the great the people on the Facebook page that have been contributing. They pull out, you know, newspaper articles and programs and personal memories that it just overwhelms me. And like I said, there's not a day go by I don't learn something. And I feel very, very happy that I'm able to present a forum for, you know, a Facebook page is only as strong as the people on it.
Right.
And it presents a forum where people can actually learn about the history of Southern California
sound
wrestling.
Like a football coach.
Yes, exactly.
We're only as strong as our weakest link.
But I want people to learn, because I feel it's very important for the men and women who worked in Southern California, who bruised themselves and hurt themselves to entertain people, to get their just due. And that's the reason why this page came about. And I'm very, very pleased about it. I'm very pleased to be doing the podcast here. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I know the first time out, we were just throwing a lot of things around.
This is a history lesson.
This is just a little history lesson. We're going to be much more focused on this because, as you were saying before, we're in for the long haul on this.
We are here. This is the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. I'm Ken Napsok. That's Dan Farron. You can follow me on Twitter as well, KOZP, and follow Dan on the Twit Machine.
At Real Dan Farron.
Real Dan. Don't accept no substitute.
No, there's another Dan Farron. It's not this Dan Farron.
Go for
this
Dan Farron. Dan Farron. So this has been the first issue. I always say issue because I'm reading too many comic books these days. This is the first episode of California Classic Wrestling on the Wrestling Viewpoint Network, and so many more to come. The next time we'll be focusing on the biggest card in the history of California wrestling, according to Dan Farron. That's a fact, right?
That's a fact.
Okay. And we're going to be talking about great names and memories. This has been fun. Great having you out here tonight, Dan. And remember to find us on iTunes, subscribe. That's step one. And then I want you to rate and review on iTunes. That's how iTunes works. The higher you go, the better you get in the iTunes world. You can also find us on Stitcher Radio. And we appreciate you guys listening. So for Dan Farron, I'm Cad Napsok for the Wrestling Viewpoint Network and California Classic Wrestling, episode one in the books. We will see you next time.